CliffCentral.com.
All right, a couple of messages coming through this morning. Let's go to those. First of all, from Robbie, I nominate Fikile Mbalula for the Big Talk Fuck All Action Award of 2016. Anushka saying, my blood pressure has been steadily rising this morning, listening to that talk about Steve Hofmeyr's backwardness, Trump's wall, paid Twitter, and now the Politicians' Awards. I, she says, in inverted commas, am going to blow up Parliament and will blame Madonna. Honestly, none of these people deserve an award. So Anushka fired up this morning. And Julian says, I received my salary last night. I got an increase of 4.21%. Last year, I got 4.5%. I hate the people in power.
Don't worry, we all do.
Yeah, that's not even keeping up with inflation. Ashley says, to be honest, I think the ANC is unsalvageable now. They've involved themselves in far too many insidious, immoral, illegal, or just plain evil things. They may have a legacy that has positives in it, but that's ancient history now. Paid Twitter is just the next in a litany of terrible stuff that the ANC will become known for by the next generation. And then an interesting picture from, who's this from? Again, it's from WhatsApp, so it's just a number. So we've got The Force Awakens, and the next movie name has been announced for this year. That's the Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi. And then the final Star Wars, they say, they haven't come up with that name yet, but someone is offering up a possibility for what that name would be. So you put it all together, it's The Force Awakens, The Last Jedi, From His Nap. So the final one will be From His Nap.
Okay, all right. I like that. That's clever.
I wish I could give credit, but I don't have a name on here. The Rat in the Kitchen was written about Pier Villabuerta, apparently. So that's an interesting aside to what Justice brought to the show this morning. And I love the burning platform, says Carl of Saints. I love it. Hashtag Nando's. And a great interview. He's incredibly humble. He was on Cliff Central as well. I'm not sure who you're talking about there, Laura, but if you can let me know, that would be interesting. And can you add a share button on the app so that I can send it via WhatsApp like Uber? Yeah, it's a good idea. We're actually looking at part three, in fact, of the app, the third update, and we will put that into action this year, sooner rather than later. Why do people have such an issue with the American border wall when almost every other country in the world has a wall or a fence? We have a fence with Zimbabwe. And I think a lot of people in this country would prefer if it were a wall and no one could get through. You know what I'm talking about, right? Lots of people who feel that way.
Well, what I've noticed is that there's a lot of hypocrisy, as always is the case. You know, you'll hear people criticizing Donald Trump for, you know, when he referred to Mexicans as rapists and drug lords and the fact that he wants to build this wall, but then ask the very same people how they feel about foreigners in this country. And then all of a sudden the story changes.
Exactly. All right. Ben's got some sport for us this morning, and we've got a little bit of time before Prof. David Block comes in. We haven't spoken to him in ages, so I'm looking forward to seeing him. He says he's caught up in hideous traffic. That was his word. Hideous. So he'll be in as soon as he can get through that. Ben, what do you got for us?
Well, just an update on the Aussie Open for you, Gareth. Coco Vandeweghe is out.
Oh, what happened there?
Well, you know, she won the first set 7-6, but after that, Venus was like, this is my time. 6-2, 6-3. She just brushed her aside, which means the first of the 6 30-year-olds go through to the final.
All right. Very, very nice.
I would love to know what the odds could have been if all finalists at the Aussie Open this year were over 30. So that's one. So now Serena will take on that Luki Baroni lady.
So it might end up being Serena versus Venus.
Yeah, exactly, which is so amazing because they're both mid-30s, right? And you would never expect that in a sport like this, especially with the way that Eastern European, Asian girls are churned out of systems to go play tennis and basically just become metronomic in success.
Well, yes, but then look at astronomical?
Oh, they just do the same thing over and over.
Like a metronome.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you look at Venus and Serena, their father said they're going to play tennis, they're going to be the best, and they ended up doing it. So sometimes it works when you do that, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, they really did. And I just think, again, every time these Grand Slam tournaments come round, you are just sort of reminded about how incredible Venus and Serena have been. So obviously, in all sports, there's been like these darlings of the era, right?
But it's interesting because Venus used to be the one.
Yeah.
Then it was Serena. And
Serena
now
was like the younger sister who was right. coming up through the ranks, but was a bit all over the place.
And now Venus is definitely still in the game.
Well, Venus obviously had that illness, which did sidetrack her quite a bit, and she would have lost out in a few majors there. But the fact that she still got it at 36.
That's 36, very good.
That's even older than me.
Very, very good.
So I think, again, it's one of those great examples how people will talk about the dominance of Tiger Woods in golf. They'll talk about Michael Schumacher in Formula One or Usain Bolt in athletics. What these Serena and Venus Williams have done in tennis has been absolutely amazing. And you know, no discredit to Novak Djokovic or Pete Sampras or anyone like that, but the sport of tennis is far, far richer because of the Williams sisters.
Yeah,
and it'd be so cool if now this could be another final. In other news from Australia.
It's all about Australia today. Huh?
Pakistan, really, they've been searching for a fuck all morning, but they haven't got one. 246-0 Australia now. 246-0.
Huh.
There's this great tweet I just saw now of the Pakistani coaching box. They're just sitting there with faces like smacked asses.
Yeah.
So that's, So if you are watching sport live this Thursday, then Serena Williams up next against Lukic Baroni.
All right. We haven't had a pastor doing something stupid this week, have we?
This week? No, not this week.
Well, wait, because it's not over yet. Here's Pat Robertson, our favorite American pastor, that old man who sits there with that lady and she reads out emails and he helps people solve their problems using the power of Jesus. Listen to this.
Okay, this is Lori who says, "My husband and I moved into a house a year ago. I'm a strong Christian with unwavering faith. I believe the Lord tried to stop us from buying it at every turn. Everything has been very difficult here. Everything has to be redone, rehung, etc. The last few months, weird things have been happening in the home. I've seen doors open and close on their own. We can't find something and then it appears, and things fall off shelves without reason. What do you recommend? I've prayed and cast it out, but I believe it will take more than one person to make this stop."
All right. So, again, I like to play the game where either Mubs or Ben tries to predict what Pat will tell the poor person who sent this email in. So here we clearly have a situation where you've got a devout woman. She and her husband have bought a house. Strange things are happening in the house. She already says she suspects that God does not want them to live in that house. What do you think Pat's going to tell her?
Ben?
What's the worst advice you can think of?
Well, I think Pat's going to basically tell them to move out of the house straight away, which is a horrible financial decision.
And what would the reason be for Pat to say that? What would his... Because you know he's going to bring in some wacky stuff.
Well, God has always been the best real estate agent in the world. So therefore, let God guide you to a better place. But move out of this place.
All right. Here it is. Here's his answer. Let's see how close Ben is to it.
"I'd sell that house in a heartbeat."
There we go. You got your money, Ben.
Sell that house in a
heartbeat. Okay, but listen to it. It gets better. Here's some more financial advice.
"I'd sell that house in a heartbeat. I would run to the nearest realtor, put it on the market, cut the price in half, and get out. That's what I would do as fast as you can. If you don't like that, get a bunch of believers to come in there and go room by room and anoint every room, plead the blood of Jesus, and cast demons out. But man, you're in for a long fight. Get out! There are plenty of houses. Why live in a haunted house?"
Hang on a second. Let me cut in here. So Pat believes in the power of Jesus, right? Yeah. And that he can do all these things. But he just said get out because the fight will take too long. So isn't he kind of contradicting himself
here? Well, he's also saying to these people, not only sell the thing which you've just bought, you're hardly going to make a profit. He's not even saying that. He's saying cut the price in half. In other words, lose half your money. And for most of us, the house is the biggest investment you'll ever make.
Exactly.
So he's basically sending these people into financial ruin, as Ben predicted.
If you were to...
Horrible advice. I mean, this should be illegal. This man should be... He should be pulled off the TV by security and taken away and put in a prison for what he's doing to people.
Can you imagine where you would live with half your money? You'd have to go to a neighborhood you probably don't want to.
I mean, it's
live in a
horrible.
Tiny place.
He's telling them... He's telling them to downgrade their life by half.
Because anointing a house doesn't actually work.
No, because he thinks the house is haunted. It's insane. He said at the end, there's no reason to live in a haunted... Listen to this. I'm not going to put words in his mouth.
There are plenty of houses. Why live in a haunted house?
It couldn't be worse advice. Doesn't this drive you mad?
No.
It drives me mad. I hate when I see, like, this person who sent this letter in. Okay, and it's a real letter. These are real people. It's not like he's making this up. They go to him because they think, well, Pat's got a conduit to God. He knows something we don't. He's a superior ape to us. Meanwhile, we're all just apes trying to figure out the world around us. And it drives me crazy. I can't tell you how mad it makes me. I should just not care, right?
Yeah,
you shouldn't. Not my problem. I don't own this house. I don't. I'm not married to this woman. But it drives me mad that there's a guy and he's on TV and he's giving terrible advice that will ruin this person. And he's doing it from a basis of no evidence at all. He's talking about haunted houses. He's telling you, slash the price in half. It's terrible advice. Why am I so upset about this?
I don't know.
Because you know this person will take the advice?
Yeah, they're going to. They're going to sell the house. They're going to end up in ruin. And he doesn't care. You think Pat's going to give a damn?
No.
No, he's probably going to ask her for money for reading out her email on the air. Cindy's just sent us a picture of a beautiful beach in Australia. Or just her son, sorry, sent the pic from Esperance in Perth on the way to Australia for a few days. Very nice. It is Australia Day today. Question for Prof. Block. Why does it mostly appear that meteor showers and eclipses are all in the Northern Hemisphere? Is it just media coverage or what? That's a good question, Nick. We'll ask him when he's in a little while. Can't wait for the prof. I missed him dearly. Absolute fan. Please make him say so, because he used to say so. Do you remember? Duncan, so. That's what he would do. A couple of other messages coming in. Here's one from someone who says, love to all, from Nikki. Craig says, shot, but I don't know what he's talking about at all. See, this is the problem with these WhatsApps. Is if we're not all on the group, we don't know what's going on. Is there a best state capture award at the SARPers, Rory? And Gareth, when can we expect #invest to have an offshore option available? Your long-time devoted and slightly obsessed listener, Vanard. Well, Vanard, it's coming. Actually, I'm proud to say that we're in the process of putting that together, and I'll let you know as soon as that's ready. But there's no reason for you to waste time and not get invested now. A friend of mine just opened up an account for their little baby who's less than a year old. And by the time he goes to varsity, it might just pay for his varsity and more.
Excellent move.
Very clever. And, hey, generally enjoying the music again this year from Unkia. Well, that's good news. Gareth, what is the WhatsApp number? Well, we had this discussion earlier this morning, and there was a lot of crazy running around by Ben to try and discover what the number was. The WhatsApp number is 079-748-2090. Put it on your phone, and you can join in the conversation anytime you like. That's 079-748-2090. See Donald Trump signing more and more legislation into action. Have you heard about the new Secretary of Defense?
Who is it?
It's a guy called James Mattis. He's a retired general. He's never been married. He has no children. They call him the Warrior Monk. And he's a hardcore guy. His most famous quote, let me read this to you quickly. This is the quote that he's most well known for. When he was in Afghanistan, he met with all the leaders of the Taliban and he said the following to them. He said, guys, let me quote from him directly. He said, I come in peace. I didn't bring artillery. But I'm pleading with you, with tears in my eyes. If you fuck with me, I'll kill you all.
Sounds like something out of a Sylvester Stallone action movie.
He's incredible. So he was sworn in on Saturday, right? He was confirmed in his cabinet post on Saturday. Went straight into security briefing. He was given information. To his surprise, there were 31 ISIS bases in Iraq and Syria that were still functional. He immediately, there and then, ordered them to be bombed, and within an hour, his instruction had been carried out. 31 ISIS bases destroyed. This is the kind of Secretary of Defense America needs. What a guy!
Yeah, it's like decisive.
Get it done! He's fantastic. He actually did work for Obama for a little while too, and then retired from that position and was lecturing at one of the universities in California on marine infantry, artillery, war. He's perpetually involved in the study of war. This is a military man through and through.
So he's a businessman then?
No, a military man.
Which is business?
Not really. Military, sometimes you
there is no better business than war, Gareth.
No, he's not profiteering out of this at all. He's interested
he's
in winning.
Of course he's not.
He's interested in winning.
That's good, Ben. That's
very
good.
And this guy is interested in supporting the troops that they already have on the ground. He's looking at scaling back a lot of the spending at the Pentagon, which has never happened before under a Secretary of Defense. They always want more money. And people are very excited about this. So there we go. Take a look. Look him up, James Mattis, M-A-T-T-I-S, and you will find a very interesting man with a very interesting career. Such a decorated soldier. He fought in Korea. He fought in Vietnam. I think he even fought in World War II. I might be wrong on that front, but he's got an incredible and illustrious military history. And certainly for soldiers, for people who are in the military, this is a guy that they want in power. They want a guy like this in authority, not a politician, because usually the generals have to take their instructions from a politician. This time the generals would be taking their instructions from a general. And let's see if it works. Again, we may be horribly wrong here, but I have faith that this guy will blow our minds with the things he has to do. All right, let's get on with it. We've got Professor David Block. I'm very excited to talk to him. I haven't seen him in a long, long time. He's looking well. He's been busy. He's been all over the world. He's been writing. He's been researching. He's been doing interesting things that we need an update on. And there are questions pouring in from people who have missed him on the show Looking Up, which we put on hiatus when he went over to Australia for an extended period. So there's loads of things that we need to talk to Professor David Block about. He's coming in next, Mubs. Aren't you excited?
Yes, we miss Prof Block.
Damn right. So, would you like some Keith Sweat before we go to Prof Block, or do you think that's inappropriate?
Well, I mean, which song?
What do you want? Good Love?
Yeah, okay.
No, yeah, I want you to be happy, Mubs.
No, that's fine.
You think so?
Yeah.
All right, let's do a little Keith Sweat this morning for you. Get you in the mood. It is Thursday. Can you believe that? Thursday. People are excited. CliffCentral.com. It's Keith Sweat with Good Love. I hope you get some of that this morning, or at some point during the day today. Now, this is very exciting. We haven't seen this man in a long time, and I'm delighted that he could be with us today because he's very busy and he has lots of things to do, and he's made some time in his schedule to see us today. I'm talking about Professor David Block. How are you?
I'm looking up, Gareth. I'm just so excited to be back here. You know, for many months, I've just missed being here. I see the universe is expanding, meaning that you have expanded. And yes, it's just so exciting to be in this awesome new space-like studio. I'm just looking up, and just the vibes are just so good here, as always.
Well, Prof, you have been away. Our listeners have missed you, and yes, you used to have your own show here, but you had to go off to Australia.
Yes.
You had many projects you were involved
exactly.
in. Tell us what you've been up to, please. Give us a little update on where you've been.
With pleasure. So, I, of course, have a passion for communication. Communication via the written medium, communication via the oral medium, and so forth. And so I've been writing a book, and it's just so exciting. My co-author is Professor Ken Freeman in Australia, which is why I went to Australia. But I think one of the key figures in the history of science, of course, is Galileo Galilei.
What a hero.
And exactly so. What a hero.
He stood up to the might of the prevailing doctrines at the time and said, you know what, space, we have to observe, we have to take into cognizance, we might not be the center of the universe.
That's right. Absolutely.
The sun is in the middle, we spin around the sun.
Absolutely.
Our sun isn't even the center of our galaxy.
And so forth. Yeah. And so I'm a detective at heart, Gareth. I just love doing some detective work. And so through contacts, very, very high level contacts, by very, very high level, I mean the director of the observatory at the papal residence, the papal summer residence, I was able to get into the Vatican secret archives.
Really?
So that was quite amazing.
Did that mean a trip to Rome?
Yes, that meant a trip to Rome. And then when I arrived at the Vatican, they, of course, took away my passport because they knew that I would be handling irreplaceable documents. Wow. And so I sat down. I can't recall if it was behind glass or not, but I sat down. They brought all the original files from the trial of Galileo Galilei. And
these are 400 and more years old.
That's right. We're looking at, around 1610 onwards. It's just quite incredible. And then, of course, his trial later. And it is just incredible for me to try and experience the emotions which Galileo Galilei must have experienced as he was traveling to Rome to face the Inquisition at the age of 70. Three physicians said he was not fit enough to travel to Rome. The Pope said, if necessary, bring him in chains.
Wow.
I actually saw that. So, well, it's very interesting. This is not just, this is not something, Gareth, that the public ever gets to see.
No.
This was the Vatican secret archives.
Now, you need to explain to me, because I'm fascinated by this. Mm. I think a lot of us would be. Prof, what an opportunity, first of all.
Thank you. It
what
was incredible.
To gain.
I know. It was incredible trust.
What did this place look like? Where are the secret archives? Are they inside? You said at the papal summer residence.
So the observatory, the Pope has a summer residence at Castel Gandolfo outside Rome.
Right.
And I believe this was a way of the Vatican sort of restoring some sort of face in the wake of the earthquakes in the astronomical arena. The Vatican wanted to show that, the Pope was still interested in matters astronomical. And so the Pope has numerous telescopes and observatories at his summer residence, which is outside Rome at Castel Gandolfo. But I then approached a former director at the observatory. So in other words, a man who would have dealings, face-to-face dealings with the Pope. And so he, of course, had access to the secret archives, but he had to get permission for me to go there. And it was a very interesting experience, Gareth, because you don't know where it is because it's a secret archive.
So is it buried in underground? Is it in a mountain?
No. It's in a building in the Vatican, mm-hmm. but you don't just get in there.
Were you led down passages?
You led down, exactly.
They didn't blindfold you.
No. They did not, but I realized I was in a very, very discreet place where very few people are ever allowed to venture. Perhaps I felt like, someone working at the CIA.
Yes.
And, so when I arrived at the Vatican, they, knew who I was, but I had to hand in my passport because I'd be handing documents which are absolutely irreplaceable.
Yes.
And then, it was meeting one person after another. And then I was led to a room, almost like a sort of, not an interrogation room, but it was a room with a desk. A round table, actually, yes. And then just glass windows. So that was quite interesting, but I didn't see any microphones, so I knew I wasn't on the Gareth Cliff show. and then a specific individual actually was instructed, from levels very high up, very senior authorities, to bring forth the Galileo manuscripts. Now, this is the trial documents, the Inquisition trial. And it was just so amazing for me to sit there and, page by page, see the proceedings, but also to see the handwriting of Galileo Galilei himself, one of the greatest scientists, no doubt, of all time. and just to feel the emotions, also to to come to the page where he abjures that the the earth might be the center of the universe under extreme pressure from the Inquisition. You know, he said, maybe I'm wrong, maybe the earth is, maybe this is just a hypothesis and not actual fact. The Vatican was trying at the time to dictate the geography of the heavens. They were arguing that the earth is the center.
And of course, the stakes were very high because they would have burnt him.
You know, it's amazing that he was not burnt at the stake. He had the right contacts. I think he had some soft hearts very high up, including, in a sense, you know, right close to the Pope. I do believe that if he was someone without all these incredibly influential connections through the Medici family, I believe that his fate might not have been, you know, as kind as it was. But let us remember that Galileo died under house arrest. I also visited his home where he died in under house arrest in Arcetri Hill, near Florence. And, you know, he was sent home to die. It's an incredible story. He was going blind, sent home to die, denied virtually all access to the outside world. It's an incredibly interesting story. But coming back to the Vatican secret archives, to actually see in Galileo Galilei's own hand, you know, the length he went to try and say, but look, I've observed through my telescopes, you know, there are satellites going around Jupiter. You know, the Earth is not the center of the cosmos. And, you know, I can hardly, you know, one thinks of Mandela in this country, the Rivonia trial, but this was a trial for the sake of science, Gareth.
Yes.
This was a trial for the sake of science in centuries to come. And it was an incredible privilege to actually sit there, you know, with these glass windows and David Block minus his passport, and to actually wade through these documents. I think the big thing that struck me so much is, on the one hand, the Pope said, you know, if he can't come up, bring him up in chains. And on the other hand, you know, Galileo trying to sort of save his life, as it were.
Yes.
Of course, you know, so many did lose their life at the stake. You know, I think of William Tyndale, the great reformer who lost his life at the stake in Belgium, strangled and burnt for translating the New Testament into English.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite an extraordinary, you know, the history of the Inquisition, Gareth, is something which is quite spine-chilling. But to see their fingers in the pie with Galileo in the audience was, to me, an unforgettable experience.
Now, Prof, when you're so close to history, and particularly the history of one of your own personal heroes, and someone who was both exceptionally brave and a tenacious survivor of the times, despite
yes.
the fact that he wanted to tell the whole story but was precluded from doing so
Absolutely.
For fear of his own life.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in that moment and you look around you and think, I'm in the Vatican secret archives. I'm busy looking at these 400 and something year old documents.
Yep.
This couldn't be better.
Yes.
At that moment, you've achieved some kind of apex of personal experience.
That is true. That is true. I mean, that is absolutely true. I mean, you know, you feel, I suppose, that this is a moment in history, in my history anyway, which I shall never ever forget, because there are no members of the public who ever get access to the yes. secret archives. Let's always remember this. This is the secret archives. You know, this is not a typescript version. This is, you know, I paged through with white gloves, of course, you know, so that acid shouldn't come from my hands onto the documents, but actually to page through the trial, the proceedings. You can imagine what must have gone through Galileo's heart and Galileo's spirit. But I suppose that, you know, as a scientist, it's one thing reading about someone. It's one thing reading about his trial.
Mm.
But to see everything in his own handwriting, and then what the inquisitors had to say, and, you know, how they defended their idea of the geography of the heavens, knowing that Galileo Galilei, you know, could die at the stake. I mean, many, many others died at the stake, as
yes.
we've already said. And yes, for me, I wanted to touch these documents. I have a very, very exciting invitation this year, Gareth, in May, to address 700 leaders in Poland. They're flying in from 45 countries, and they are allowing me there to hold the original manuscript of Nicholas Copernicus in my hands.
Man who put the sun at the middle.
That's right. That's absolutely right. But coming, so that's an incredible experience to look forward to, and we might chat about that. But Galileo Galilei, of course, is just the central figure in the history of science. Multitudes of books written about him, but I don't know how many authors have ever had access to the Vatican secret archives. And I just have to thank the people right close to the Pope for allowing me access to these documents, where the emotions must have reigned so incredibly high. And yet, Galileo won out. It's just an extraordinary story with the, you know, the entire force of the Inquisition behind him and in front of him. But he, you know, truth prevailed.
Prof, what can we look forward to this year in astronomy? You must have your eye on the calendar at the beginning of every year because there's so many things that happen, from comets to meteor showers to planetary alignments.
What have we got in the cards? You know, Gareth, the interesting thing in my career is we never know what will happen next. I think one of the most exciting recent discoveries has been the discovery of gravitational waves. That, to me, blew my mind. You know, Einstein...
Can you explain these to us?
Yes, with pleasure. You know, Newton always believed that there's a force called gravity and that, you know, every body attracts every other body, basically.
Based on its mass.
Based on its mass, exactly.
It's one of the four great forces.
Gravity, you know, you've got the electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, and then the force of gravity. So it's one of the four fundamental forces which cements our universe together. But it was regarded very much as simply a force. In other words, there's body A, there's body B, and the law of gravity, the Newton's law of universal gravitation says they attract each other, you know, with a force which is proportional to the product of their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distances between their centers. So that was fine. But when Einstein came along, he dreamt big. Now, Newton always thought of bodies existing in flat space-time. Everything was flat, meaning that, you know, the sun was there and the earth was there, but that the space between the earth and the sun was just flat space, like in the studio.
Two-dimensional.
That's correct. That's right, like almost a Cartesian plane, XY axis. But Einstein, of course, you know, dreamt of this, imagined rather, this idea of space-time. But, you know, amazingly, you know, Einstein envisioned that space-time wouldn't be flat, but it would actually be curved. Mm. And that gravity, you know, wouldn't just be, space wouldn't just be empty space, but that gravity would propagate by means of what we call gravitational waves. In other words, these are waves emitted by these masses, of course, very high near black holes, but very low near our Earth, but that they are gravitational waves. Gray waves carrying the force of gravity to other bodies. It's an extraordinary idea.
Do they, as waves, do they have an amplitude?
Absolutely so. So these are gravitational waves. They've, you know, very, very long amplitudes indeed. But, you know, just like when you look up and you see light, how does the light reach my eyes? You know, essentially wave packets of light and photons are reaching my eyes second by second. But to think that gravity actually propagates in terms of waves. I mean, you know, I take, for example, an apple, and then I let it fall. You think the space between it is flat, the space between the apple and the desk is flat. But here you've got waves. I mean, even in the studio, waves, gravity propagating by waves. I'm drawn by my feet to the center of the earth, and so are you. But it's incredible to think that if you've got a star and a black hole, for example, there'll be gravitational waves propagating between them. And, you know, that discovery to me has been one of the most remarkable discoveries, vilifying, you know, affirming the work of Albert Einstein. I just loved Albert Einstein, Gareth, because of his imagination. You know, Einstein dreamt that space-time would not be flat, but would be curved. And a prediction of his theory is these, you know, gravitational waves, which were believed to exist if his theory was true, but to actually detect them, you know, via some very sophisticated equipment was actually very, very encouraging for me. And so I just never know what I will see next through the world's greatest of telescopes. That's the exciting part.
I'm also fascinated by this gravitational wave thing. So when you talk about black holes, they obviously have the most mass in the universe.
Not necessarily, sir. It's interesting. They are just, you know, for example, if the sun works squeezed just to, you know, a little size like this, just, you know, a couple of centimeters, under 2-3 centimeters, it would form a black hole. So black holes can result from massive stars, maybe 10 times the mass of the sun, maybe 20 times the mass of the sun, but not too much. I mean, 20 times the mass of the sun is not that extraordinary. But if these stars run out of gas, what happens? The star collapses and collapses, and there's no longer any outward radiator force to keep them up. Once a star runs out of gas, out of fuel, just like your car comes to a stop, these stars, when they run out of gas...
When you say run out of gas, yes, you mean nuclear fuel, obviously.
Absolutely.
You don't mean actual hydrogen and
helium.
That's
right. So, in other words, what I'm saying is, at the center of our sun, hydrogen fuses into helium.
Right.
And that is a thermonuclear fusion process.
Reaction, right.
And it keeps the sun up, as it were, against the inward tug of gravity.
Yes.
But if the sun were to run out of hydrogen gas, hydrogen fuel at its core, then you haven't got the essential ingredient to drive the thermonuclear process under these extremely high densities, temperatures, and pressures. And if the sun were to run out of hydrogen gas, it would collapse because you've no longer got any outward radiative force at the core, and so gravity takes over. And that's the heart of a black hole. That's the heart of the story of a black hole, Gareth, is that once a star runs out of gas, meaning the thermonuclear fuel, the fuel to drive the thermonuclear process, the star collapses. And if, you know, the one possibility is it collapse and collapse and collapse and form what we call a white dwarf, which is very interesting in its own right. And we can talk about that if you want.
Mm.
And then stars collapse yet more if they're more massive to what we call neutron stars, where everything in the star is made out of neutrons. It's incredible.
Really? No protons,
so
no electrons?
Let's just go through this. Right. In the white dwarf stage, the electrons around the parent or atoms become dislodged as the star collapses inward and inward.
Because,
and
again,
inward,
if the densities and
absolutely,
the pressures and the forces,
everything happening in there, the electrons can't be bound to their parent nuclei. But electrons are negatively charged. And so this floating sea of electrons
will
repel each
around.
Other.
But they'll swirl
around, absolutely, but then they'll repel each other because electrons are all negatively charged, and that can halt the collapse. And when that collapse is halted, that we then call a white dwarf.
So as I understand it, then your star itself is composed only of nuclei.
Yes.
Surrounded by the swirling cloud of electrons.
Well, it's surrounded by this ocean, if you like, of negatively charged electrons, which are degenerate, meaning that, you know, you've only got electrons now, and they're negatively charged, but they're there, and the repulsive force is strong enough to halt the collapse. But that only works if the star's not too massive. If the star is very, very massive and it's collapsing, the negatively charged electrons, Gareth, collide with the positively charged protons in the nucleus to form neutrons. And that's when you have a neutron star.
What does it look like?
A neutron star would be only made up of neutrons. So it would be nothing like you and I know conventional stars. I mean, we observe neutron stars in the sky as spinning specks of white light, and they can emit a lot of radiation, but they have crusts. Neutron stars have crusts. Neutron star crusts can undergo earthquakes. It's material we're not used to at all. Never really at all.
This is incredible. Neutrons are their function in the nucleus of an atom,
yes,
is to, in some way, share the subatomic particles that protons share.
That's right.
In order to keep the nucleus
everything
coherent.
Together. Yeah. Exactly.
Now,
exactly.
If a neutron star,
yes,
is composed only of neutrons,
yes,
these must be the greatest collections of.
That is true.
Non-charged.
That is true.
Matter.
Absolutely.
Anywhere.
Absolutely. That
what,
is.
What I do mean, they even do with themselves? Everything's about charge and force and.
Well, that's right, but not these. These spin around. They've got angular momentum. These neutron stars spin around. They develop thick crusts of neutrons, and then as they spin around, sometimes the pressure inside these neutron crusts gets so high that they activate earthquakes, and then the pulsar or the neutron star can spin up, and it then can then slow down. I actually, at the age of 19, wrote a very interesting research paper, Gareth, on earthquakes on the in the crusts of neutron stars, and it's fascinating stuff. It's just amazing.
There must be, just to go back to stars for a second, and
yes,
the way that they generate, that it's a fusion reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Hydrogen nuclei become helium.
That's
nuclei,
right.
So mm-hmm, you add,
yep,
an extra proton and,
yes,
neutron every time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are these producing, is there so much helium being produced by all the stars of the universe that we have a surplus of helium being created?
It's not so much a surplus, as hydrogen fuses into helium and then into heavier elements. And then, of course, in the sun, for example, that radiation is emitted as a result of the thermonuclear
alpha
pressure.
Alpha particles.
All of that. Alpha particles. I mean, if you think of the aurora, what are the aurora? They, a stream of high energy particles from the sun, such as xenon and argon and krypton and so forth, which stream in from the sun, all produced as a result of everything that's happening within the solar surface. So you've got all these particles there. The thermonuclear process is an exceedingly interesting one. And so hydrogen goes into helium, fuses into helium. This gives rise to electromagnetic energy that then propagates to the Earth and elsewhere. And so when you look up at stars, you're looking at the interiors of stars, if you could do so, you're looking at the byproduct, Gareth, of thermonuclear fusion.
And these are the engine rooms of all the elements.
Yes. Oh, I like that. That is just, that deserves an award. That, I mean, that is just, say it again, Gareth.
Engine rooms of the elements.
Wow, that turns me on. That is just, wow. You've made my day from the traffic. Engine room of the elements. Yes. That's where the elements of which you and I are made. You know, you and I are carbon-based material, and carbon is cooked in the interiors of stars. That's, you know, how do we get carbon on Earth? Where does it come from? It comes from the result of stars exploding. Now, in those stars, you've got the engine factory for all the elements. Eventually, when some stars explode, they spew out all these elements into space, including iron, nickel, carbon, and all other elements. And that's the stuff of which we are made. That's why Sir Fred Hoyle said, we are made of the stuff cooked in the interiors of stars.
Wow, this is spectacular. Now, you were busy telling me you get white dwarfs.
Yes.
You get neutron stars.
Yes.
Now, if a very, very supermassive star,
that's correct,
collapses in on itself,
yes,
that's when you get a black hole.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, now, black holes, very, very complex science around these. We talk about event horizons. We talk about curved.
That's right.
Space.
Absolutely.
But what for those of us who are maybe not as well versed as you are in the science of black,
yes,
holes, explain to us whether it is at all possible to create these things.
Yes.
To artificially,
yes,
make them.
Yes.
What their purpose is in the universe,
mm-hmm,
and what would happen if we were to observe them at close quarters.
Well, let's go to the third question first. I love that one. What would happen if we went to close quarters? Now, if you're dealing with a very, very supermassive black hole, I give this as an exam question often to my students, what would happen to you? Well, interestingly enough, The density is mass over volume. So let's just take something very simple of a spherical black hole, you know, 4/3 pi r cubed. Mm-hmm. And the mass scales as the radius,
right,
with a black hole.
Sure.
So you've got...
that's the measurement from widest point to widest.
That's
point.
Right. So the mass scales as the radius from the center to the outermost limit. So you've got density...
Sorry, mine was diameter.
Yes, right, exactly. Yeah. Yours was diameter. So you've got mass over volume. Mass goes as radius. Volume goes as r cubed, so density goes as 1 over r squared. So that's very interesting. If you've got supermassive black mm-hmm. holes, you won't know that you're going in them. This is an incredibly interesting point, is that the density, as you cross event horizon, for very, very massive black holes only, not the sort of stellar mass black hole, but, you know, black holes, supermassive, you know, the mass of the galaxy, 10 to the 11 solar masses and so on. The density goes over 1 over m squared. 1 over m squared. So 1 over the mass squared. So the bigger the mass, and then you still square it, and you're taking its inverse. So I have given
it's a very, very small, very negative number.
It's a very, very positive number, 1 over m squared.
Oh,
1
right. sorry,
over
sorry, sorry,
m
yeah.
squared, because the mass is positive, right. But the m squared is a huge number. If m is huge, m squared is huge. I mean, if it's 10 to the 11 times 10 to the 11 and you're 10 to the 22, that's a 1 followed by 22 zeros. So that's big. Then when you take the reciprocal, you're getting 10 to the minus 22. So it's 0.00.
Right, that's what I was getting.
And
at.
So that's what you meant.
It's a fraction.
And so that's right. And so that's the amazing thing. That's the density around the event horizon of these black holes, these supermassive ones. And so you wouldn't even know. This is incredible. But you wouldn't even know you're crossing the event horizon. Now, once you cross the event horizon in your rocket, you'd find something very strange happening. If you start accelerating your rockets to try and come back home, you won't be able to. There's a force of gravity which has taken over, and it's sucking you inward and inward and inward. So in other words, when you travel through the event horizon, you wouldn't know nothing's happening. But when you get through the event horizon, you'll find... In mathematics, in calculus, we say r dot is negative. It means the radius where you are continuously decreases as a function of time, meaning you are being sucked inward and inward and inward and inward to the center of the black hole. That is extraordinary to my mind. And then when you get to the center, the central region,
yes,
nobody knows what happens. Nobody. Stephen Hawking has worked on this, the idea of wormholes, you know, going through the wormholes to other universes and some. But at the singularity, nobody knows what actually happens because, Gareth, all known laws of physics break down at the singularity.
So you could... Theoretically, anything is possible, and theoretically, nothing is possible.
Well, I would say this, and perhaps it sounds a little negative, but I would say that, you know, on the basis of what we do understand, you'd be sort of pulled in one direction, called a tidal stretch, pulled by gravity in one direction, the long direction, and then pulled by gravity in this area. So you'd actually be pulled out like a sheet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd, of course, die. I mean, the tidal forces would be far too severe on your body. You'd be literally, I mean, it would be the worst torture of any kind in my mind, because it's like having weights at your head and feet pulling you like this, like they did do at the days of the Inquisition with a rack. It's a despicable device. And then the other one, you know, pulling you this way, you know, that's the sort of, I think if you want to know what happens in a black hole, ask the Inquisitors.
God, Prof, this is, what a way to tie the stories together. people have questions for you. Let's get to those. I don't want to make this all about my questions because we'll be here all day. Someone asked, why do all the meteor showers and interesting astronomical events seem to occur in the Northern Hemisphere? Is it because they get more media coverage? Is it because there are more observatories there? Or are they cheating us out of something? What's the real story?
Well, the real story, I suppose, is that, you know, in the North, you did have people like Patrick Moore, And, you know, his was the longest running show, I believe, Gareth, in BBC history. And he made he helped people to fall in love with astronomy. And that's what I loved so much about being on your show, you know, for just so long, was that, and earlier when you were at your other radio stations, was that I seek to help people fall in love with astronomy. It's not as if, you know, the Northern Hemisphere is privileged astronomically, astronomically wise, because the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way, is best seen from the Southern Hemisphere. Let us always remember we've had glorious eclipses from the Southern Hemisphere. Let us always remember those glorious lunar eclipses we spoke about, remember?
Yes, and in fact, we have better observatories in the South, don't
we? We've got beautiful, and let's remember the SKA, this huge square kilometer array, is, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere. I mean, you know, largely in South Africa and Australia and so on, but an international project, and yet in South Africa. And so I'm very proudly South African. And I think one of the things, Gareth, is we are far too centered on politics in South Africa. There's not enough room for science. I'm sad to say that, but at the BBC, they gave Patrick Moore room. Yes. They gave him room. Meaning this. They supported him. They loved his work. They supported him financially. They helped him write over 50 books. I mean, that's an extraordinary number. I mean, Patrick Moore was as well known as Prince Charles. I walked with Patrick Moore in London, and it was amazing. He was buying a loaf of bread, or I can't remember what he was buying. But, you know, typical Patrick Moore wouldn't have the bread made for him, even though he probably died a multimillionaire. But, you know, he bought bread. He's a very eccentric man, of course. But I stayed in his house and so forth. And, I mean, walking with him in the street, he was as well known as Prince Charles. So, you know, everybody greeted him, everybody in London. It was like walking with the Queen, I suppose. It was just amazing. But the point I'm making is, there are very few Patrick Moores. There are very few Carl Sagans. When Carl Sagan was alive, he did such a good job. And that's what I love about you, is like this morning, you're giving me space to help people fall in love with the night sky. It's not as if great things only happen in the Northern Hemisphere. They are incredible. Incredible. I mean, you know, I spend my life, well, of course, I travel, but I mean, a large fraction of my life I'm spending in this country.
Can I ask you, just to digress briefly, because we are running out of time, and I promised you we'd only keep you here for a little while, but I'm going to go right up to the end on this. You've been on campus in the last year. Things have been very difficult.
Yes.
For lecturers, for students.
Yes.
It's been complicated. There's been a lot going on. You've had some incidents happen before your very eyes.
Absolutely. I would say that 2016, rather, Gareth, was the worst academic year I've ever faced. You know, you can imagine lecturing on the beauty of mathematics and partial differential equations, and then there's the loudest of bangs. And I turned around, and an explosive device was set off in my lecture theater, and all the students scattered. But there's a one, and also then, I was on campus, I was escorted by riot police. The one day I lectured, I mean, just imagine this. Ugh. I'm lecturing about astronomy and applied maths, and there's riot police in front of me, protecting me. When my students wrote my exams last year, Gareth, I was escorted by armed police with machine guns to my car, because, of course, protesters were stealing exam scripts. And that's a year I never, ever, ever wish to relive again, because my life was at stake. And while I absolutely adore all my students, and I understand the extreme frustrations, I shall never lecture under conditions where I have riot police needed at my door,
absolutely,
where I've got explosions going off. They call them firecrackers. Believe me, these aren't just ordinary firecrackers. Gareth, they measured about 12 to 14 centimeters long.
Like a stick of dynamite.
That's right. That's right. A stick of dynamite. That's a very good analogy. And about 5 centimeters across. I mean, this was war. I went to the Great Hall and they were stoning it. I mean, there was tear gas. There were rubber bullets. The one day I said to my colleagues from my office, what's this noise I'm hearing? They said, oh, Prof, it's just some bullets going off.
Good heavens.
It's just so different.
You can't, this is not an academic environment.
Not at all. Not at all. And I don't know, and I don't want to go into all the politics of this, but I'm on the ground, and I would absolutely say for my beloved students that this is not an academic environment at all.
Yeah, well, I'm very glad you're okay. I'm glad that there were no real incidents of life lost or anything else in your immediate environment.
Well, there was a life lost,
well,
Gareth.
Yeah, I know
there was. There was a guy, I think it was a Mr. Ntuli, and he was a cleaner at the residences, and they were letting loose these fire extinguishers which released deadly gases, and he was asphyxiated, apparently, so I don't know what the forensic findings were.
Prof, you've just created an award.
Yes, that's, you know, Gareth, this is so exciting because, I'm often asked to speak at functions and events. And so I was invited to the school, Cambridge High in East London, and yes, there were all these awards for sports, awards for, you know, distinctions in maths and in science and the best student in A and in B, and you know how it goes, and glistening awards. But I thought to myself, just hang on a second. There's no award for not giving up. Think of Churchill. He nearly gave up, but he didn't. He said, we will fight on the beaches, we will fight everywhere. But there's no award for not giving up. Think of Edison. We sit here as a result of the fruits of Edison. But Edison tried 3,000 times before developing the first practical light bulb. And so I thought, where's the prize for the Edisons? Where's the prize for those who never give up? Where would Edison be in this mix? So where would Churchill be?
Which school did you gift this award to?
And so I awarded it to a school called Cambridge High in East London. They'd flown me down to speak at their award ceremony.
Okay.
And so it's called the Professor David Block Trophy, but there's an emblem of a star, you would have noted,
yes,
above it. It's called the Professor David Block for stellar determination in never giving up on the blackest of nights. And that's David Block. And so I've just awarded this, and I believe that for the next 18 years, there's slots for 18 names there, people at this school. And I'd like to say, Gareth, we need to do this at more schools, really,
yes,
to have trophies for never giving up. But yes, that is the David Block Trophy. I just want to salute all those who are hearing my voice this morning and just never, ever, ever give up.
CliffCentral.com.
We will see you tomorrow. Have an excellent day in the company of CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com.